genetically lacking. Vitamin C must be directly ingested, usually in the form of supplementation, as well as in the diet, to maintain adequate levels inside the cells in the tissues versus the more commonly measured levels in the blood throughout the body. Tissue cells contain greater concentrations of vitamin C than are found in the blood. As a result, ingesting only enough vitamin C to maintain a given blood level is no guarantee that many of the vitamin C-rich tissue cells will have enough vitamin C available to them from the blood to reach and maintain their proper concentrations. It should also be realized that the human body does not have the ability to synthesize any vitamin C whatsoever. However, this is not the case with most other animals. Generally, nearly all mammals, reptiles, and amphibians have the ability to synthesize at least some of their daily requirement for vitamin C. Most mammals synthesize vitamin C in their livers, first measured experimentally by Grolman and Leninger, and other animals, primarily reptiles and amphibians, can achieve this synthesis in their kidneys. This ability is felt to be completely lacking in humans, as well as in primates, fruit bats, and guinea pigs. Interestingly, the very fact that the guinea pig cannot make any vitamin C for itself is one of the primary reasons that it has served scientific researchers so well. The guinea pig can be made ill or toxic much more easily than a vitamin C-producing research animal, and there is less variability in the guinea pig's response to a given stress compared to other animals that can respond with internally produced vitamin C. Researchers quickly realized that guinea pigs and primates, including man, seemed uniquely susceptible to a wide variety of clinical syndromes, including life-threatening shock and infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, diphtheria, and polio. Of course, it eventually became apparent that experimentally induced scurvy required an animal such as the guinea pig that could not produce its own vitamin C, or another animal that could produce only small amounts. Chatterjee et al. Examined the abilities of different species of animals to produce their own vitamin C. Among the mammals tested, they found that goats were especially capable of producing significant amounts of vitamin C. In fact, goats had a rate of production of vitamin C that was roughly 13 times greater than that of cats or dogs. All wild animals tested had at least a fourfold greater rate of vitamin C production compared to cats or dogs. This is likely one of the primary reasons that these two most common domestic pets will keep the veterinarian busy with so many of the same diseases that afflict their human owners. Although they do produce some vitamin C, dogs and cats produce it less readily than many other animals, and compared with wild animals, they are much more easily stressed into a state of vitamin C deficiency. For example, the efficient vitamin C-producing adult goat can internally manufacture more than 13,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily to maintain its optimal health when it is not facing any significant challenges to its health. Even more amazingly, goats are also believed by some to produce as much as 100,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily when faced with life-threatening degrees of infectious or toxic stress. Researchers, such as Levine, have argued that it is quite difficult to recommend an optimal daily dose of vitamin C for the human being. However, few investigators familiar with the bulk of research on vitamin C would maintain that the human RDA dosage is nearly enough to meet all of the body's needs. Connie et al. Demonstrated that animals having the ability to synthesize their own vitamin C could produce about 10 times more than their baseline levels when subjected to enough biochemical stress, such as from drugs. This automatic ability to adequately step up vitamin C production in the face of stress explains why so many wild animals tend to live healthy for their entire lifespans until it is time to die. Conversely, generally vitamin C-depleted human beings will typically spend at least half of their lifetimes coping with one or more chronic diseases. Dogs and cats are generally somewhat healthier than people, but their limited vitamin C synthesizing ability is eventually overwhelmed as they grow older and face greater cumulative toxic stresses, resulting in more disease than seen in wild animals. Even the rabbit, which can produce roughly 5 times as much vitamin C internally as the dog or cat, can be malnourished to the point of eventually dying from what appears to be a metabolic condition closely akin to scurvy. It should not be hard to understand, then, that an added vitamin C-utilizing condition, such as a significant infection, can push even vitamin C-producing animals to the point of clinical scurvy. The specific genetic defect that prevents humans from internally synthesizing vitamin C is the lack of a liver enzyme known as L-glucuronolactone oxidase, GLO. GLO is the last of a sequence of liver enzymes that ultimately transforms glucose, blood sugar, into vitamin C. Interestingly, the actual GLO genome, or sequence of coding DNA, has been identified to be present in humans. For unclear reasons, this segment of human DNA remains untranslated, meaning the recipe for GLO is present in the human but remains unprepared. This raises the possibility of potentially exciting new avenues of research for today's genetic researchers. If a way can eventually be found to get the already present genetic code for GLO to turn on and continually produce GLO, the health of the human population will leapfrog to levels that may seem literally unbelievable today. Human beings would then be able to continually synthesize vitamin C from glucose, and there would be far fewer toxic or infectious challenges that could cause illness. As is already seen with the many vitamin C-producing wild animals, such a human could then be expected to remain much healthier until the expected lifespan had run its course. A thorough examination of the literature reveals another potentially exciting way to address the human being's inability to synthesize vitamin C that does not appear to have been seriously addressed. While not always practical or clinically effective, genetically based enzyme defects can sometimes be addressed by the direct administration of the missing enzyme. Sato et al. Administered GLO harvested from either chickens or rats to guinea pigs. Giving this enzyme to guinea pigs enabled them to survive vitamin C deficient diets. At the very least, this should stimulate further research into the feasibility of giving such direct enzyme replacement therapy to humans. Hadley and Sato established a protocol involving long-term GLO administration to guinea pigs that was successful in maintaining a high proportion of those animals. These results would certainly seem to warrant further serious research on similar treatment programs for humans. Assisting the liver in performing what should be a natural function is a very desirable clinical goal. Perhaps regular therapy with GLO enzyme replacement, supported by more vitamin C when toxic and other environmental stresses present themselves, might be a very good health-supporting regimen. Certainly, stimulating the liver to release vitamin C directly into the bloodstream would undoubtedly help support the oral and other non-intravenous forms of supplemental vitamin C. The scientific literature specifically addressed in Chapter 2 clearly shows the vast clinical superiority of intravenous vitamin C over any other form of vitamin C administration. Often, a significantly smaller dose of intravenous vitamin C compared to an oral administration will promptly result in the clinical resolution of an infectious disease. A human's inability to produce GLO must be considered something of an inborn error of metabolism. This metabolic error was also induced in the vitamin C-producing rat by Mizushima et al. They were able to establish a mutant rat colony that produced no GLO, the same defect normally found in guinea pigs and humans. As with other such inborn errors of metabolism, every attempt should routinely be made by a treating physician to consider this lack of enzyme activity in every medical condition. This translates into a very simple approach. Always give vitamin C on a daily basis, and always give enough. To date, There are no infectious diseases that have ever been found in which vitamin C administration can be considered dangerous or inappropriate. This is the case, even though there has already been roughly a century of research on vitamin C, involving the publishing of some 50,000 to 100,000 scientific articles. A handful of case reports, which will be addressed in more detail in Chapter 4, gives good reason to exert a minimal amount of caution when administering vitamin C under a very limited number of clinical circumstances. However, no evidence has ever been produced to demonstrate that a regular opt-dose of vitamin C should be avoided by anybody. Everybody requires an opt-dosing of vitamin C on a daily basis to reach and maintain optimal health. No human body can operate effectively and stay healthy without such an opt-dose. The only real question that remains is what one's individual daily opt-dose should be. This, too, will be addressed later in more detail. It is an incredibly rare situation for an inborn error of metabolism like the one resulting in GLO deficiency to be shared by all humans. There are many other inborn errors of metabolism, but these affect only certain unfortunate individuals. However, there appears to be a primary assumption in the medical community that a 100% GLO deficiency is a genetic trait shared by all human beings. From my review of the scientific literature, however, it does not appear that a serious study was ever undertaken to see if all humans were equally lacking in this critical liver enzyme. Consider the anecdotal reports that one occasionally hears about a certain individual living to 100 while smoking and drinking every day of his adult life. Although one can be blessed with a much better immune system than others, the ability to synthesize GLO, at least to a limited degree, could also be the reason for an otherwise incredibly long and healthy life. Any inborn error of metabolism is also not completely expressed all of the time. Certain enzyme levels may be depressed by 10%, 50%, or 90%, but not necessarily 100%. This must also be considered a possibility for the levels of GLO in different people possessed of greater longevity, at least until careful studies can determine otherwise. Cummings pointed out that some individuals enrolled in vitamin C depletion studies were discontinued from those studies when no symptoms of scurvy developed, or when vitamin C levels did not drop significantly over an extended period of time. It seems that there was never any serious curiosity over whether these individuals could continue to have vitamin C in their bodies over even longer periods of time. If any individuals could be identified with even partial GLO production and internal vitamin C production during periods when dietary vitamin C restriction resulted in scurvy for the remainder of the individuals studied, even more exciting avenues of research could be pursued. It is always easier to research a condition that is not possessed by all. Further support for the concept that all human beings might not be completely lacking in GLO and the internal production of vitamin C comes from studies with guinea pigs. Williams and Deason reported that one guinea pig continued to survive after 8 weeks on a vitamin C-free diet, which should have produced scurvy. Before long, several other investigators concluded that some guinea pigs could synthesize vitamin C, thereby accounting for the occasional wide variability in the laboratory requirements needed to induce scurvy in these animals. In spite of this research, there still does not appear to be any enthusiasm or significant interest in looking systematically for those occasional humans who can also synthesize some vitamin C. Cummings further points out that if the lack of GLO in humans comes from the same recessive genetic trait as is found in other genetic enzyme deficiency states, then occasional mutations should be expected to occur that would again allow GLO to be expressed and vitamin C to be synthesized. However, if any of that is true, a deliberate search should be made to find such vitamin C synthesizing individuals. Some findings may fall into a researcher's lap, but many must be specifically sought out, or they will not be found. Historical background. In its classical and full-blown form, scurvy is a painful, unrelenting, and uniformly fatal disease. Few physicians today ever get the opportunity to even see a case of classical scurvy of the kind that decimated navies, armies, and explorers of centuries ago. A treatise on the scurvy describes the first symptoms observed that heralded the appearance of scurvy. The first indication of the approach of this disease is generally a change of color in the face, from the natural and usual look to a pale and bloated complexion, with a listlessness to action or an aversion to any sort of exercise. When we examine narrowly the lips or the corners of the eye, where the blood vessels lie most exposed, they appear of a greenish tinge. Meanwhile, the person eats and drinks heartily and seems in perfect health, except that his countenance and lazy, inactive disposition may portend an approaching scurvy. Classical scurvy in humans can only occur when vitamin C levels in the plasma, the fluid part of the blood free of cells, approach zero and remain so for a number of months. Lund and Crandon et al. Reported on the deliberate induction of scurvy with a vitamin C deficient diet. Crandon was able to eventually demonstrate in himself a complete absence of circulating plasma vitamin C. He developed small skin hemorrhages after about 5 months and demonstrated poor wound healing after 6 months. Other investigators were able to induce the signs and symptoms of scurvy in a group of 5 prison volunteers before plasma vitamin C levels completely reached zero. The ability of any given individual to develop scurvy will depend upon how absolutely the diet is deficient in vitamin C and how healthy and well-fed that individual was before the vitamin C intake was stopped. The body's stores of vitamin C vary significantly, and the presence of underlying diseases and chronic toxin exposures will also substantially increase the rate of utilization of whatever vitamin C stores are present. As vitamin C levels in the plasma approach zero, the levels of vitamin C eventually become severely depleted throughout the tissues of the body. When the depletion of vitamin C is severe enough, the scorbutic, scurvy-stricken individual is incredibly weak and prone to very easy bleeding. Virtually all motion produces excruciating pain, and the gums are typically infected. Teeth are no longer soundly anchored in the gums, and the breath develops a putrid smell from the infection. The skin is mottled with spots, many of which relate to bleeding within the skin. The legs and knees also tend to be swollen in the late stages. The immune system is always severely compromised, and a secondary infectious disease, such as tuberculosis or pneumonia, will often take hold and end up being the immediate cause of death. Interestingly, many scurvy victims did not appear wasted and malnourished. Rather, full-blown scurvy would also occur in individuals who were overweight and considered well-fed in terms of the food amount eaten. This observation seems to underscore the important concept that a good quality and proper variety of foods are vastly more important for overall nutrition than the amount of food eaten. Lind, who came to be known in Great Britain as the father of nautical medicine, conducted what many considered to be one of the first experimental clinical trials that utilized a truly scientific methodology. While on board ship, he selected 12 sailors who already had scurvy and then formulated 6 different regimens of dietary supplementation to be given to 6 groups of 2. All of the sailors were given the same basic diet throughout the day. 2 sailors also received 2 oranges and 1 lemon daily for 6 days, while the remaining 10 men received other dietary supplementation that did not contain any significant amounts of vitamin C. Lin's other supplementations were termed elixir vitriol, vinegar, seawater, cider, and a concoction containing nutmeg, garlic, mustard seed, horseradish, barley, myrrh, and cream of tartar. At the time, all of these concoctions were considered as candidates for having some anti-scurvy effects. After only 6 days, the two fortunate recipients of the citrus fruits had already recovered to the extent that they could resume their normal onboard duties. The trial could not continue any longer because Lind only had enough oranges and lemons to last 6 days. None of the other men showed any significant improvement, although the two men given what was only termed cider, along with the regular diet, did show some lessening of their weakness. Lind's trial also served to dramatically demonstrate that very little vitamin C given for a very short period of time can still be very effective in acutely relieving the symptoms of clinically full-blown scurvy. Because a vitamin is generally considered to be needed in only very small amounts to prevent a known deficiency disease, this dramatic clinical response of scurvy to very minimal vitamin C dosing is the primary reason that vitamin C first came to be considered a vitamin. As mentioned earlier in this chapter, however, such minimal doses of vitamin C are only enough to prevent the advanced symptoms and fatal complications of scurvy. Such small doses will not prevent the development and perpetuation of the many diseases associated with chronic vitamin C deficiency. Summary. Vitamin C has long been mislabeled as a vitamin, at least in the strictest sense of the definition. This mislabeling has been one of the primary reasons that the proper dosing, optidosing, of vitamin C remains largely unappreciated. Improper dosing of vitamin C continues to be the main reason for any scientific paper to claim that vitamin C was without effect in treating a given infectious disease or medical condition. Genetically speaking, human beings and a few other animals cannot translate the DNA code for the vital enzyme L-glucuronolactate oxidase, which is needed to convert glucose into vitamin C internally. This genetic defect is the main reason why humans are so much more prone to infections and diseases than many wild animals. Humans are totally dependent on ingested sources of vitamin C. Repairing this genetic defect, or compensating for it, could improve the health of humans to an almost unimaginable degree. Scurvy, a uniformly fatal disease when left untreated, results when a human has been completely deprived of vitamin C long enough to demonstrate little or no plasma vitamin C for several months. Relatively small amounts of vitamin C can save a scurvy victim from death, but much larger amounts are needed to optimize health. Chapter 2. Curing, reversing, and preventing infectious diseases. Everything that is written in books is worth much less than the experience of one physician who reflects and reasons. Arbaces. Paving the way, Frederick R. Klenner, M.D. Even today, only a very small number of medical researchers and clinicians completely appreciate the enormous benefit that can be obtained for a wide variety of infections and diseases by the proper use of what is considered very large doses of vitamin C. Frederick R. Klenner, M.D., led the way in both advocating and using the routine administration of these high doses of vitamin C for a wide variety of diseases, many of them infectious. Although primarily a clinical doctor rather than an institution-based researcher, Klenner also managed to publish at least 20 significant papers that documented the successful outcomes that he repeatedly achieved with many patients in Reidsville, North Carolina. After obtaining bachelor's and master's degrees in biology, Klenner went on to earn his medical degree from Duke University in 1936. He spent 3 more years in postgraduate training before deciding to go into the general practice of medicine. It was only in the late 1930s and early 1940s that vitamin C became readily available and economically affordable as a pharmaceutical. In his early medical practice, Klenner subjected only himself to the initial large doses that he would later use on his patients. He then proceeded to use similarly large doses on his patients, and the results were absolutely unprecedented. Polio, curable and preventable. Although the viral syndrome known as polio is seen only very infrequently in the United States anymore, it still takes a substantial toll in some of the poorer countries around the world. However, even though the terror that polio inflicted on so many babies and children was at its peak about 50 years ago, many individuals in the younger generation who did not see its effects firsthand still appreciate that it was and is considered an incurable disease. In fact, the 21st edition of the Cecil Textbook of Medicine clearly asserts that no specific treatment is available for polio, adding that supportive care is essential for dealing with pain and increasing the chances of survival. Both the general public and the medical specialists share the view that polio has to run its course if it cannot be prevented by vaccination or otherwise avoided. It is also generally appreciated that many of the polio victims fortunate enough to survive the acute infection have to subsequently endure a lifetime of being crippled to a lesser or greater degree. A great deal of the public awareness of this disease also stems from the vivid images of our polio-stricken former president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who struggled greatly to be seen in his wheelchair as little as possible in public. President Roosevelt's condition also made it clear to the public that polio and its crippling side effects were not limited to only babies and small children, but included unfortunate adults as well. The data demonstrating the ability of vitamin C to cure polio is of worldwide concern, since polio outbreaks still occur. From August 16th to October 17th, 2000, 33 cases of acute flaccid paralysis, considered to be secondary to polio, were reported in Cape Verde. From July 12, 2000 to February 8, 2001, 12 laboratory-confirmed poliomyelitis cases were reported in the Dominican Republic. These latter cases were attributed to vaccine-derived poliovirus type 1. Regardless of the cause, however, polio continues to infect babies and children, and doctors must be prepared to treat these patients with the best therapy available. When I first came across Klenner's work on polio patients, I was absolutely amazed and even a bit overwhelmed at what I read. I had already worked on a number of different medical conditions with large intravenous doses of vitamin C, so I was not completely surprised by the fact that the polio virus could be easily eradicated by vitamin C. However, I was not prepared to easily deal with the spectrum of emotions that would grip me. To know that polio had been easily cured and so many babies, children, and some adults still continued to die or survive to be permanently crippled by this virus was extremely difficult to accept. As a child, I swallowed the little sugar cube polio vaccination along with all of my elementary school buddies, and we all prayed the same prayer, hoping against hope that the virus boogeyman wouldn't attack us as we slept. Even more incredibly, Klenner briefly presented a summarization of his work on polio at the annual session of the American Medical Association on June 10, 1949, in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Galloway and Seifert reported on Klenner and the other presenters in their article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Landwehr discussed this occasion and commented on its possible significance. Klenner's comments followed an extensive presentation on the best-known ways to support the ability of advanced polio patients to continue breathing. Klenner made the following remarks. It might be interesting to learn how poliomyelitis was treated in Reidsville, North Carolina, during the 1948 epidemic. In the past 7 years, virus infections have been treated and cured in a period of 72 hours by the employment of massive, frequent injections of ascorbic acid, or vitamin C. I believe that if vitamin C in these massive doses, 6,000 to 20,000 milligrams in a 24-hour period, is given to these patients with poliomyelitis, none will be paralyzed, and there will be no further maiming or epidemics of poliomyelitis. One doctor made comments before Klenner, and four doctors made comments following him. The four doctors who commented after Klenner did not have anything to say about his assertions. They were only concerned with making their own observations about how a polio patient who had difficulty breathing could best be assisted and given a better chance to survive. Although Klenner managed to publish his landmark article only a month later, which documented his cure of 60 out of 60 cases of polio during the 1948 polio epidemic, his comments at the annual session apparently were little heeded and quickly forgotten. Perhaps his results were just too fantastic to be believed. In the Journal of Southern Medicine and Surgery, Klenner gave an in-depth accounting of his impressive treatment and results on polio patients. He noted that all 60 of his patients presented with all or almost all of the same signs and symptoms during the epidemic. Fever of 101 degrees Fahrenheit to 104.6 degrees Fahrenheit, headache and pain behind the eyes, bloodshot eyes, reddened throat, nausea, vomiting, constipation, and pain between the shoulder blades, in the back of the neck, in the lower back, and in one or more limbs. 15 cases had confirmatory spinal taps, and 8 had been in contact with another proven case of polio, helping to confirm the clinical diagnoses. Spinal taps were generally avoided since they were felt to promote the access of the blood-borne virus into the nervous system through the puncture site. Also, with the sameness of symptoms occurring during an acknowledged epidemic of polio, spinal taps were not justifiable for diagnosis. Even if a skeptical individual does not think that all 60 of the patients had polio, there is no question that the vast majority of them did indeed have the disease. After diagnosis, Klenner promptly initiated the massive vitamin C therapy. He even noted that the administration of the vitamin was much like that of an ordinary antibiotic. For children and babies under the age of 4, the vitamin C was given as an intramuscular injection. The initial dose varied between 1,000 and 2,000 milligrams, 1 or 2 grams. Body temperature was utilized as a practical guide to continued treatment, and the same dose was repeated in 2 hours if no drop in fever had been observed. If the temperature did show a clear drop, the next dose was held back for another 2 hours. This dosing schedule was followed strictly for the first 24 hours. Klenner noted that the presenting fevers were consistently down after the first 24 hours, and vitamin C was then given at the same dose, but only every 6 hours. This dosing schedule was continued for 48 more hours. Klenner noted that all of the patients were clinically well after this 72-hour period of treatment. However, when 3 patients had a subsequent clinical relapse of symptoms, Klenner decided it was best to continue the vitamin C administration for all of the patients under treatment at the same dosage for an additional 48 hours. During this final 48-hour period, vitamin C was dosed at either 8-hour or 12-hour intervals, and a complete and permanent resolution of the symptoms resulted. It is also very significant to note that none of the 60 patients treated by Klenner had any of the residual deformities so characteristic of many polio survivors. It would appear that the cure of all 60 polio patients was complete and absolute. Klenner even noted that 2 of the patients already had advanced disease to the point where fluids were coming back through the nose. This was a symptom that typically heralded the progression of the disease to the point that breathing support would be required, and the chance of deformity and even death would be significantly increased. However, the recoveries of these 2 patients were also complete. Klenner, September 1956, also published some of his clinical observations on the use of vitamin C to treat polio in two older patients. One 21-year-old woman presented with deep eye pain, leg pain in the hamstring area, pain in the neck and lower back, and a general desire to keep her entire body in a fixed position to avoid painful movements. She had a fever that reached 104.6 degrees Fahrenheit, along with a sore throat that had relapsed after an initial treatment with antibiotics, aspirin, and fruit juice 2 weeks earlier. It is interesting to note that the small amounts of vitamin C in the fruit juice may very well have kept the symptoms from evolving more quickly and definitively. In any event, Klenner felt the clinical diagnosis of polio was straightforward, and this 118-pound patient was immediately given 22,000 milligrams of vitamin C by slow intravenous injection with a 100cc syringe. She then took 1,500 milligrams of vitamin C with juice every 2 hours at home. 12 hours later, she was free of her headache and had a fever of only 101.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Klenner then gave her another 22,000 milligram injection of vitamin C. There was some nausea and vomiting for the next 30 minutes, but after 24 hours, she had a temperature of 100.8 degrees Fahrenheit with definite clinical improvement noted. 18,000 milligram injections of vitamin C were then given every 12 hours. Then 5 10,000 milligram injections were given every other day. Oral vitamin C was continued for an additional week at 1,500 milligrams every 3 to 4 hours. Klenner noted that the patient had an almost complete elimination of pain, except at the knees, after the first 48 hours. Temperature had normalized after 84 hours. Other than some thiamine, vitamin B1, injections to help nervous tissue recovery, vitamin C was the only medication given to achieve a prompt and complete recovery. Another patient, a 28-year-old female, presented with a very comparable clinical picture. She also demonstrated the same type of response after 96 hours of similarly dosed intravenous and oral vitamin C therapy. Even if one were to argue that both of these patients had a severe form of influenza rather than polio, the clinical responses they demonstrated to these large doses of vitamin C are nonetheless very dramatic. Getting over the flu in only 3 to 4 days would still be a modern medical miracle, regardless of the treatment used. In another case reported by Klenner, an 8-year-old boy presented to Klenner's office with a history of flu-like symptoms during the prior week. The child was continuing to be bothered by nausea and vomiting, sore throat, and a deep-seated headache at the back of his eyes that had even failed to respond to adult-sized doses of aspirin from his mother. Klenner took note of this clinical picture, along with a few other classical symptoms, and he had little doubt the boy was having difficulty recovering from the polio virus. By any standards, the boy's recovery was remarkable, even if the syndrome had been due to another virus. He had a fever of 104 degrees Fahrenheit and continued to cradle his head in his own hands in an attempt to find relief. He was also beginning to have some localizing symptoms, characteristic of polio, in his lumbar area, lower back, and left hamstring. Klenner gave 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously immediately in the office. The boy was then sent to the hospital, where he promptly received another 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously. Repeated injections were then given every 4 hours. Only 6 hours later, with no other pain medication, the severe headache was completely relieved. The nausea and vomiting had resolved as well. Klenner commented that this previously miserable child was actually now in a jovial mood. The boy was discharged after a hospital stay of 48 hours, during which he had received a total of 26,000 milligrams of vitamin C. A lesser oral regimen was continued to prevent a relapse that Klenner realized could occur whenever vitamin C therapy was severely tapered or discontinued too soon. Whether it was flu or polio, the response was prompt, and the cure was complete. Even today, modern medicine does not have a single effective and non-toxic virus-killing drug. In an especially incredible case, Klenner described a 5-year-old girl stricken with polio. This child had already been paralyzed in both her lower legs for over 4 days. The right leg was completely flaccid, limp, and the left leg was determined to be 85% flaccid. Pain was noticed especially in the knee and lumbar areas. 4 consulting physicians confirmed the diagnosis of polio. Other than massage, vitamin C was the only therapy initiated. After 4 days of vitamin C injections, the child was again moving both legs, but with only very slow and deliberate movement. Klenner also noted that there was a definite response after only the first injection of vitamin C. The child was discharged from the hospital after 4 days, and 1,000 milligrams of oral vitamin C was continued every 2 hours with fruit juice for 7 days. The child was walking about, although slowly, on the 11th day of treatment. By the 19th day of treatment, there was a complete return of sensory and motor function, and no long-term impairment ever resulted. Vitamin C not only completely cured this case of polio, it completely reversed what would undoubtedly have been a devastating, crippling result for the remainder of this girl's life. As one reviews the work of Klenner, it can readily be seen that he did not stick to hard and fast formulas on how much vitamin C to give to a certain patient. He always based subsequent dosing on the degree of general clinical response and the extent to which an elevated temperature had been lowered from the previous vitamin C dose. Although this is completely appropriate, it may make some potentially adventurous physicians a bit reluctant to try using large doses of vitamin C on different viral syndromes without a fixed schedule of dosing based on diagnosis and body size. As will be shown later in this book, this fear is completely groundless due to the lack of toxicity of vitamin C at even the highest doses. The greatest practical concern of high-dose vitamin C therapy is not an overdose of vitamin C, but an underdose. Typically, the acutely ill patient will not get a high enough dose of vitamin C for a long enough period of time, and the treating physician will then think that the less aggressive vitamin C dosing represents all that can be done with this agent. Some viral diseases, to be discussed later, can metabolize as much as 300,000 to 400,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily. In these cases, the only way to assure a complete recovery or even survival is to maintain such an elevated dose until the virus has been completely destroyed. There are some viral syndromes that may even require still larger amounts of vitamin C. The rule of thumb in vitamin C treatment of viral diseases is to continue increasing the dose as long as the clinical response is inadequate or unsatisfactory, and to continue the treatment period until all clinical symptoms have disappeared. Vitamin C and polio, supportive research. Although the clinical cures that Klenner achieved with the vitamin C treatment of polio stand completely on their own merits, it should be of interest to note that earlier basic research had already suggested that vitamin C was a very effective killer of the polio virus. Jungablut demonstrated that vitamin C could completely inactivate the polio virus outside of the body, in vitro, rendering it non-infectious, even when injected directly into the brains of monkeys. Salo and Cliver demonstrated this in vitro inactivation of the polio virus by vitamin C more recently. Pelu et al. Also showed that vitamin C, along with hydrogen peroxide, inactivated the polio virus. Jungablut later induced experimental polio in monkeys by this same direct injection technique into the brain. He found that about 30% of the 62 infected monkeys, which had also received injections of vitamin C, escaped developing paralysis. In the control group, only about 5% of the survivors escaped paralysis. This demonstrated that vitamin C could kill the polio virus in an infected animal, in vivo, as well as in a test tube, in vitro. Although Jungablut's use of lower doses of vitamin C, relative to Klenner's dose levels, did not demonstrate the level of clinical efficacy achieved by Klenner, Jungablut's results clearly showed that vitamin C was an agent capable of killing the polio virus in research animals and preventing subsequent neurological damage. This virus-killing effect alone deserved significant recognition, since vitamin C was such a non-toxic therapy. Furthermore, Jungablut's much smaller doses of vitamin C were given by a different route of administration than used by Klenner. Also, the virus had already been injected directly into the brain before the vitamin C treatment began, thereby giving the virus the ability to quickly progress to an advanced state of infection. Jungablut, desiring to make sure that the data in his work was statistically significant, repeated his efforts with another 181 monkeys and again found that approximately 30% of them survived their infections without paralysis. Jungablut later demonstrated a comparable virus-killing ability of vitamin C in monkeys when a different infecting strain of the polio virus was used. These studies allowed Jungablut to clearly confirm that vitamin C by itself could kill the polio virus in infected monkeys. It remained only for doctors such as Klenner to discover the most effective protocols for the administration of vitamin C in humans for diseases such as polio. Greer also reported excellent clinical results in his treatment of 5 polio victims with only oral vitamin C, given 10,000 milligrams at a time. This vitamin C dose was given as often as every 3 hours for up to 10 days. The total daily oral dose of vitamin C would range from 50,000 to 80,000 milligrams. His patients ranged in age from 5 to 43 years of age, and 2 of the patients did have slight residual weakness in a leg after treatment was complete. Bauer also reported positive effects using only 10,000 to 20,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily, shortening both the total time of illness and the time it took to normalize the elevated body temperatures. However, in light of Klenner's success at seeing no residual damage in 60 out of 60 patients, it would appear that intramuscular and intravenous administrations of vitamin C get tissue levels of vitamin C to an optimal range more effectively than only oral administrations. Using oral vitamin C appears to best serve as an adjunct to the other forms of vitamin C administration, and oral vitamin C is obviously the form of choice for long-term daily usage to stay healthy and prevent disease. Additional viral diseases and vitamin C. Viral hepatitis, curable and preventable. Acute viral hepatitis, a serious infection of the liver, afflicts between 0.5 and 1% of the United States population annually. Conservatively, this incidence of hepatitis translates to at least 1 million new cases every year. The current medical textbooks still maintain that there are no specific curative therapies for this disease and provide only non-specific recommendations aiming to treat symptoms while avoiding whatever might aggravate the underlying process. When the acute syndrome has not completely resolved or subsided on its own after a 6-month period, the patient is generally considered by definition to have chronic hepatitis. Roughly 2% of the United States population is felt to have chronic hepatitis. Chronic hepatitis results in upwards of 10,000 deaths annually in the United States, and roughly another 1,500 patients with this disease survive to receive liver transplantation. Acute viral hepatitis, which keeps many people sick for extended periods of time, even if it does not result in chronic hepatitis, is easily and readily completely curable if treated promptly with adequate doses of vitamin C. The effects of vitamin C on hepatitis patients who have already proceeded to the chronic stage is less well defined, although some evidence indicates that a high enough dose of vitamin C for a long enough period of time would probably resolve this disease as well in many of the cases. Klenner considered vitamin C the drug of choice for viral hepatitis. His general recommended dosing of vitamin C for hepatitis was 500 to 700 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, given every 8 to 12 hours by vein. He would also give at least another 10,000 milligrams daily by mouth in divided doses. Routinely, a complete resolution of the hepatitis could be expected in 2 to 4 days. On occasion, Klenner would achieve a cure of viral hepatitis with only oral vitamin C, as sodium ascorbate. Presumably, such patients were less ill or more reluctant about being stuck with needles. One case reported by Klenner was given only 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C in water or juice every 4 hours. All signs and symptoms of the hepatitis were gone by 96 hours. This involved a total of 120,000 milligrams of vitamin C by mouth over the 4-day period. Smith reported on further dramatic successes that Klenner had with viral hepatitis. One 27-year-old male who was acutely ill with jaundice, yellowed eyes and skin, nausea, and 103 degree Fahrenheit temperature received a total of 270,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously and 45,000 milligrams of vitamin C orally over the next 30 hours. After this relatively brief period of time, the patient stopped spilling bile in his urine, his temperature was no longer elevated, and he returned to work. Another Klenner hepatitis patient, a 22-year-old male acutely ill with chills and fever, was treated over a 6-day period. He received a total of 135,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously and 180,000 milligrams of vitamin C orally. He, too, had resolution of his symptoms and went back to work. Of particular interest was that this man's roommate also contracted hepatitis, but he had to remain in the hospital for 26 days with only bed rest as treatment. Klenner treated another male hepatitis patient over a 6-day period with a total of 170,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously and 90,000 milligrams orally. During this 6-day period, the patient's SGOT, a liver function test abnormal in acute hepatitis, had gone from 450 to 45, very high, to near normal. Smith also reported on a case of chronic hepatitis that Klenner treated successfully. This 42-year-old male had already been treated unsuccessfully with steroids over a 7-month period. Although Klenner wanted to treat this patient much more aggressively, he was wary that some of the other doctors on the hospital staff would eventually deny the patient any vitamin C therapy if too large a dosing regimen of vitamin C was ordered. Nevertheless, he still managed to administer 45,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously 3 times a week and 30,000 milligrams of vitamin C orally daily for about 5 months, finally achieving resolution of the disease. Chronic hepatitis will generally prove more difficult to completely eradicate than acute hepatitis with vitamin C therapy, even though the acute viral form of this disease is virtually always a completely curable disease, if treated promptly and vigorously with vitamin C. As you may surmise from that information, Klenner would always use his clinical expertise in determining how vigorously to treat his patients with vitamin C. He prescribed vitamin C by general guidelines according to clinical and temperature responses. Part of the reason for this clinical approach pertains to how deficient the patient was in vitamin C body stores before the disease ever took hold. Any given patient can require far more vitamin C than a seemingly comparable patient if the body stores of the two patients were not comparable in amount prior to the onset of the infection. However, patients with chronic active hepatitis have decreased blood vitamin C levels and laboratory indicators of increased oxidative stress, and this indicates that some vitamin C supplementation is always appropriate in such patients. Other clinicians have achieved clinical successes similar to those of Klenner in the vitamin C treatment of acute viral hepatitis, and often much less total vitamin C was administered. Dalton reports on a 20-year-old female presenting with the typical clinical picture of acute hepatitis. For the first 3 days of her illness, while she received only complete bed rest as her primary treatment, little clinical improvement was seen. However, she was then started on a series of vitamin C injections, and over the remaining 6 days of her hospitalization, received a total of 2,000 milligrams vitamin C injections. After only the second injection, she remarked that she no longer had the feeling of being sick. Although she remained hospitalized for several more days, she wanted to go home the next day. Dalton, a medical doctor, commented that this case was the most dramatic recovery from hepatitis that he had ever observed. Even though the patient appeared to be completely cured of hepatitis, she did require a longer period of treatment with vitamin C than Klenner typically needed with his higher dosing regimen. A dentist, Orens, reported on his personal experience with hepatitis B. By taking a combination of 25,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously and 20,000 milligrams orally, Orens had a near normalization of extremely elevated liver enzymes, SGOT, SGPT, and LDH, over only a 5-day treatment period. Orens also indicated that he only took vitamin C for a period of 10 days. Although Orens was originally advised by his physician that he might be out of the dental office for a period of 6 to 12 weeks, he was back to working full-time by the end of his 10-day course of vitamin C. By the time 2 additional months had passed, there was a total normalization of his liver function tests. Bauer and Staub also reported that acute viral hepatitis responded positively to 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day, accelerating the resolution of symptoms and shortening the overall duration of the illness. Kirchmeier similarly reported that 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily for only 5 days markedly improved the clinical status of 63 children with acute hepatitis. The vitamin C was administered either intravenously, by rectal infusion, or both. The jaundice was noted to clear more rapidly, and hospitalization times were cut roughly in half. Swollen livers were noted to subside much more quickly as well. Betkin, again using 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day, reported similar excellent clinical responses in 245 children with acute hepatitis. Calleja and Brooks reported on a case of acute hepatitis treated with intravenous vitamin C. A liver biopsy on this patient revealed that he already had cirrhosis, chronic scarring of the liver, with superimposed acute hepatitis. The cirrhosis was attributed to long-term heavy alcohol intake. A 5,000 milligram dose of vitamin C was given intravenously daily for 24 days. On this regimen, the patient had a dramatic clinical response. His anemia, low blood count, resolved, and his white blood cell count and analysis returned to normal. He gained weight, recovered his appetite, and lost all of the abdominal fluid that he had been accumulating due to the progressive failure of his liver. His only liver function test that did not normalize with the treatment was the one that reflected the irreversible cirrhosis part of this liver disease. Perhaps most significant was the complete resolution of the inflammatory changes on a repeat liver biopsy. Such changes classically accompany acute hepatitis and end up persisting to some degree whenever chronic hepatitis subsequently develops. Of further interest is that this study utilized much smaller doses of vitamin C compared to those used by Klenner. Nevertheless, a complete clinical success was eventually achieved. Cathcart is another physician who has repeatedly witnessed the ability of vitamin C to easily eradicate the infecting virus in acute viral hepatitis and achieve a complete clinical cure. He reported that he never had a single case of acute viral hepatitis fail to respond to properly dosed intravenous vitamin C. Cathcart also noted that he has never observed any of his vitamin C-treated acute hepatitis patients subsequently develop chronic hepatitis. He noted that the acutely elevated liver enzyme levels, SGOT and SGPT, typically started dropping dramatically